back, Red Eyes members. We are talking to James Follett about his film Church of Global Warming. Again, his website is climatereview.net. And we're going to continue carrying on here, discussing some of the things that are that James bring up in his film. I want to touch upon some of these areas, as well as talking about ClimateGate, an issue that James unfortunately didn't have did not cover in the film because of the fact that ClimateGate were happening just around the time when James were finishing up the project. But there's a few things here, James, that I'd like to talk about, mainly surface temperature stations. This is one thing that was actually new to me. I know that this is a big part of what you were looking into as well. When you detail some of this in your film, did you primarily look at U.S. surface temperature stations, or were this from around the world? Refresh my memory regarding that.
Well, in the movie, I concentrated on the U.S. because one of the big boys in the blog world, Anthony Watts, has a huge project, surfacestations.org, to document the quality of surface stations. And why is this important? Well, it's important because the HADCRUT and the GISTEMP, which are the two major global temperature data sets, are based on surface stations. So he wanted to see whether they're viable or not. There's urban heat island effect they're worried about. But whether I used America because that's where the project is. The principle applies. Now, I mean, I can't say I covered all bases, but I do try to cover as many bases as I can think of. And so when I used America as an example, I can say, well, it's the same for the world. If you can look at on YouTube, there's a it looks rather old, but there is a little demonstration that shows over the last 100 years the number of surface stations across the world, and it declines rapidly from the beginning of the century. So all over the place, including places like Russia and China as well. So the whole world's data set is reducing, not only in numbers, but if you look and believe what surfacestations.org is saying, in quality, in a quite a pronounced way.
Mm. Absolutely. And there's just the level of how should we put it then? The inefficiency when it comes to placing these stations as well is pretty interesting when you look around some of the images around the internet, which shows some of these surface temperature stations being placed next to air conditioning units various parking lots where cars are parked and stuff, things like this. Tell us a little bit more about that, James.
Well, I think probably it's the turn of the century when, after the world industrialized and man's science level was rising, they really saw the value to understanding temperature. You know, temperature came with such an important thing, and with aviation as well, it's humongously important. So early on in the century, people realized temperature is important, so they set up weather stations. And to try to be consistent, you don't want to move your weather stations year by year, because every place you put it has a microclimate. So, you know, if you put it on the top of the hill, it's going to be perhaps cooler than if it was down in a little valley, which can warm up a bowl of heat, you know. So they don't want to move them. But the problem is, and they generally put it around the cities, because even then they realize there's an urban heat island effect, even though the IPCC to this day refute it, which is amazing, even though it's well-documented science. So they generally try not to move them, which is fair enough. The principle is correct. Mm. However, the cities have expanded and gone through the areas which were often or could have been, you know, rural or, you know, semi-rural are now urban. So that will, of course, pollute the continuous data set. And so that's a large problem, with maybe 80-90% of the stations in America have this problem.
Yeah.
So what I tried to do in my movie was I based the initial science over most of my slides, most of my presentations. I was trying to actually use IPCC acceptable data.
Yes.
But just draw different conclusions. You know, I was trying to actually minimize the controversy. Now, I mean, I've looked into the controversy, but I have to say, because I'm not a professor in the field, I can't explain every single nuance. I admit that. I can't do that. But I tried to look at it as much as I can. So I tried to actually use unbiased data. It's only on this, perhaps at the end of my scientific exploration, then I go on to the politics and economics. At the end of the scientific exploration, I say, well, even the data I'm using, I've actually been kind of, you know, I've been kind. Mm. I've been generous. We actually, if you look at the data I'm using, it's even that's been fudged. And that's where you come onto your whole ClimateGate, because the urban heat island effect is a obvious fudge, which is, I would say, almost irrefutable. Then there's even more dark fudges which come into perhaps play with the climate gate. Yeah,
absolutely. There's a few other kind of main areas as well that you did look into. For instance, tree rings, another one of these things that we hear a lot about, evidence for global warming. But tell us a little bit about the nature of what kind of trees they choose to drill into and so forth. There's a huge controversy there as well, isn't it, James?
Absolutely. I have looked at Michael Mann's original paper, and in his paper he mentions more than just tree rings. He mentions sediments and other sources, other proxies, you know, other sort of methods to elucidate historical temperature. I don't know how much depth I should go into for the audience, but there's many different data sets that he says he used. Mm. But according to people like Steve McIntyre, at the end of the day, he may have cited them, but really what he used was bristlecone pines. And he took it from pretty much one site and relatively few trees. And some would argue maybe only just a single tree is actually the basis of his temperature reconstruction. So the data set is not exactly the most impressive. And the actual data itself is 100% questionable. The reason being is, you know, a high school biologist will know that growth is not necessarily to do with temperature. Growth is to do with many limiting factors. Many things, you know, nutrients in the soil, temperature is one, but really rainfall is the most important thing.
Yeah.
And bristlecone pines can survive in desert conditions, and they can go into hibernation for hundreds of years, hence they live for, you know, 1,000 years or more. But they can survive very harsh conditions and they can go into hibernation. And the harsh conditions may not be a temperature change necessarily, it'd be a lack of water.
Yes.
So he is correlated tree ring width, you know, he's done his dendrochronology with tree ring width, and he said, well, this is to do with temperature. And you go, well, that's not really the proxy. The proxy is to water availability. So it is a bit spurious. And this was the foundation, in IPCC 3, I think it was? It was the foundation of that report, which was the thing they were heralding, and they cited something like 5 times throughout, you know, the 1,000-page report. This is the crux of the matter. Look at this. This is the temperature of the last 1,000 years. And, you know, when you look at what it's based on, you got to worry a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. And this kind of leads us a little bit into the area of the influence of the sun as well. This is a major, obviously, key point in the whole discussion here, that we have changes taking place on the sun. And our knowledge about the sun is also very recent. We not too many years ago, have started to put up satellite that directly monitoring the sun. We have SOHO satellites and so forth. They're monitoring solar flares, corona mass ejections, and things like this. What can you say in terms of the sun, and how does the IPCC incorporate this into their models, if at all, James?
Well, the climate models, I would love to give you a definitive answer, but no one knows except for the team, as they call it, the core people that belong to the whole ideology, based quite largely around the climate research unit, the CRU in East Anglia. What goes in the models is non-transparent. I mean, they haven't released their code. They won't. They said when they were questioned in the Freedom of Information Act, I think it was McIntyre again. He's getting a good showing this evening. I think it was him who was asked for their data set. Mm. It was McIntyre and McKendrick together. They asked for the original data, and they go, "Oh, we destroyed the original temperature data." It's like, well, that's good. Yeah. All we have is our adjusted massage figures. So, and the problem is, they actually say, as far as I could see in the IPCC, that the sun has influenced us over history, over a long period, but now that's irrelevant because CO2 has taken over. That's what they have said.
Yeah.
So they sort of covered their bases a little bit by saying, yes, sun has been a factor, but then they've actually created their own little quagmire because why doesn't it still affect us? Why has it suddenly stopped in the last, you know, 50 years or 20 years? Why has CO2 become the dominant force and suddenly the sun is being discounted?
Absolutely. And I mean, there's great research by Danish professor from Copenhagen, Henrik Svensmark, who's done a book called The Chilling Stars, which basically more into details about this and cloud cover and things like this. And because, again,
cosmic rays, yeah.
Absolutely. We're coming into a different, I guess, era or epoch right now as well in terms of the weather. We are having incredibly cold weather up here in the north, and UK has one of the worst, you know, winters in about 100 years, I think, in total. So something is definitely changing there. But now, so their argumentation should be starting to fall apart. And in some camps, then, they absolutely are. But what do you see this is going here in the future, depending on if we get continued cold weather? Do you think that they will spin this in the direction of saying, yeah, but this is actually also because of CO2 or global warming, because, and you know, fill in the blanks, yes, if you will, yeah, right there, you know?
Well, yeah, they are having a tough time, the poor guys. Svensmark's work, that's pretty awesome, and that's to do with cosmic rays and showing an inverse correlation between solar and cosmic rays. And in my presentation on my website, I do actually talk about that, but in the movie, I left it out. I thought it was just getting too much detail. I mean, I was trying to go for the intelligent layman to get the central points, you know, of the argument. I mean, it's a massive field of study, and yes, I was trying to go for the central ones. Cosmic rays is definitely an alternative hypothesis, and because it was still a hypothesis, I thought I'd leave it out. I'd try to keep to the harder facts. Well, there's always say facts. Harder hypotheses, shall we say. But yes, I was very tempted to include the cosmic ray. I did sort of hint at it a little bit, because I did talk about solar forcing. Yes, well, you raised quite a few points there. The other point you mentioned was, oh, it's all cold at the moment, you know, and snowing left, right, and center, and Ireland's in trouble with massive floods, and yeah, all this cold spell going across, and the iguanas falling out of the trees in Miami because they're going into stasis because there's not enough temperature for their cold-bloodedness. Yeah, which is quite funny. We have iguanas here as well. They're very cool-looking lizards. Very colorful. I mean, all that the world is like, there's a cold snap. I mean, here in Sydney right now, it's very deliciously balmy and warm, but it's a cold snap in the world, in the Northern Hemisphere especially. Mm. And then the Chinese, one of the officials from the equivalent of the Met Office, I think of the Bureau of Climate Change or something like that, because they actually play with the climate in China quite a lot. They do a lot of cloud seeding. One of the officials at the Bureau there said, yeah, this cold snap is proof of global warming. It's like, well, sorry? Mm-hmm. Him, I guess, trying to infer the fact that it's a destabilization of natural, you know, rhythms, you know, so therefore must be global warming, because global warming is all about destabilizing the environment, which I would disagree with totally. And as I show in the movie, there are not any more hurricanes, there aren't any more floods. You know, if anything, global warming actually stabilizes the environment, and most scientists would agree with that, even though politicians seem to be spinning that catastrophe scenario in terms of not necessarily like a tipping point catastrophe scenario, but just a general destabilization of the environment, which is not the case. Warming generally stabilizes.
So what's your take on the whole approach of what basically what CO2, carbon dioxide, actually is? EPA over in the States, for instance, have basically classified CO2 as a pollutant. What's your take on this, James?
Well, that's really bringing it into politics more than anything to do with science, of course. The whole EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, ruling, or the edict laid down by Obama, President Obama, is a complete contravention of the whole legislative process in America. And you're wondering why the Senate are up in arms, because they've just been bypassed. So the whole of Congress has to agree on this emissions trading, a cap and trade, whatever you want to call it, scheme that President Obama wants to put in place. They've got to through the House of Representatives, the lower house, but the upper house are like, wait a second, this is going to cost us a lot and we're not sure about it. We're not going to go for it. We're actually going to say no. And President Obama's saying, well, I'm trying to show to my international political friends who aren't really taking me seriously, because I haven't actually produced any of the goals that I had set myself to. The Middle East is still in strife. I haven't sorted that out, and I can't do the most important for the Americans, I guess, is their medical bill can't get through. It's a complete mess. At least I can get this one sorted. I'll just circumvent the whole process and say that CO2 is a pollutant, which means that it goes straight through any voting process. There's no transparency. It goes straight through that. And the EPA can then classify it along like arsenic poisoning of your river. And therefore, any CO2 that industry gives off, they can say that's a pollutant and they can fine them. Done deal. Hmm. no Congress agreement required. And doing that, and you know, some slightly more right-wing networks like Fox and some other networks which are not so right-wing or not so on the ball aren't even mentioning it. They're keeping quiet about it. But, you know, people like, you know, networks like Fox are going, wait a second, and telling the American people this is what's happening. Mm. You know, President Obama, this is what the biggest tax in your history, greater, what he wants be greater than the tax that cost America for World War II, of all things. Mm. That's how much we want to fork on you. And we haven't even voted on it, let alone had a referendum, like a national vote. So, yeah, the whole EPA thing is a shocker. And I think, personally, I was fully for President Obama, of course, when he first came in. We all wanted to have a first black president in America. It's a very important thing, I think, for society and for people around the world to see that. And Americans knew that. But unfortunately, I don't think he's delivering by doing those sort of tactics. He's got to win his battles, you know, openly, not underhandedly.
Well, that kind of connects us with the whole debacle with the Nobel Peace Prize and stuff like that, considering that Obama got that and now sending more troops to Afghanistan. That's a side note, though, but what we can mention in regards to the Peace Prize is, of course, Al Gore and IPCC being given this as well. What do you think about that?
Well, I went to a very fancy public school in the UK, and when I looked at the sort of the process occurring, it was that sort of old fuddy-duddy and respect and all that, which is good. And I loved my school. It was an awesome school, and I loved that sort of 500-year-old school and the history and all that. And I felt that was sort of happening as I saw Al Gore walk down and Pakhauri to pick up his Nobel Prize as well. And I just thinking, you're going through this process, and I have so much respect for that process, but what it's been turned into is a complete farce. Mm. And I found it pretty sad, actually, because the Nobel Prize is the highest honor, really, mankind. This is what people believe, you know, the general people in the world, when you hear about Nobel, whether it be for peace prizes or for medicine or for science, you know, you really think this is the highest, you know, award, honor that man can give someone. And you're thinking, oh my God, what's happened here? I mean, how did this happen? You know, because it's a complete subversion of the process, and it really is dumbing it down, and it's just a shame. I think it's pretty sad.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And, you know, you touched upon something previously here that was kind of interesting in terms of some of the developments over in China and so forth. You mentioned briefly cloud seeding. There is a lot of talk about weather manipulation in different ways, of course, using different technologies and doing things like this. Is this an area that you've been looking into at all? Is there a possibility here for technologies being used in order to steer weather or weather systems in certain directions, for instance, to I guess spur on the illusion, if you will, then of global warming and climate change, James? What do you think?
Well, man will inevitably try to control everything around it. That's what we do, and we're considering how small and insignificant we are. I'm quite impressed by how much we can influence our environment. But, you know, at the same time, we are just a blip, and some would consider a parasite on the planet. I don't consider ourselves a parasite. But we're only insignificant. The climate will do whatever the climate will want to do. It is way more powerful than anything that we can control. Now, locally, for instance, in the Beijing Games, allegedly, because the ruling party in China doesn't always like to disclose these things, allegedly they fired up rockets into the air to do the reverse of what, you know, cloud seeding is often to seed them for the clouds, which are nearly rain clouds, to make them rain clouds, which is basically putting in condensation nuclei. So you need little microparticles for the raindrops to form. And sometimes you can fire, substances up into the, let's say, dry ice in the old days. So you can fire them up into the clouds and make clouds which are nearly rain clouds. You know, you can't make something out of nothing. It's got to be nearly a rain cloud and make it rain. Well, in the Beijing Games, they did the reverse because they didn't want it during the, I think it was the opening, I can't remember the opening ceremony. I think it was the opening ceremony. They didn't want it to rain, funnily enough. Mm. And it didn't rain. So we don't know whether it's true. But in China, they do use this a lot to try to help some of their provinces which have got, you know, droughts and et cetera. So the Chinese are, in some ways, the communism is working there. In the West, if we want to have cloud seeding, oh my God, the amount of regulations and the worries and the amount of, you know, 10, 20-year case study projects? Are we hampering the environment? The Chinese go, we need it. We need the ring now. And they do it.
And they do it, so, yeah.
That's one of the advantages of having, you know, a totalitarian society. Sometimes it works for your benefit. But whether it's working, you know, I don't know. Yeah.
The question there as well then that connects with this is who controls the sky? Because again, if we have China doing this over certain areas, I would say that this would absolutely then influence the whole system, as it were, because this might, in the end, means that some of the rain, if you will, and if you follow my train of thought, is taken from potentially other parts of the world. It attracts moist, it creates rain over one area, and another area might be without, and they might experience drought. So again, we have kind of back to this problem: who can regulate this? Who shall oversee and control all of this, if it's allowed or not? What do you think, James?
Well, if we had a cap and trade scheme, we had a one world government, we wouldn't have that problem, would we?
Oh, God.
So, yeah, I mean, that's one way of looking at it. Yes, you're definitely right. Now, they do cloud seeding, and I can't go too much in depth there around here. There happens to be cloud seeding locally. And one of the main concerns, and it is a true concern, and you pointed out as well, by the green groups here, and this is the green groups have got their place. I don't disagree with that. It's just sometimes the extremism. But I do agree. I'm fully green myself. Don't get me wrong, audience. I do believe in green. They're just getting it right. Is the rain that they're taking and putting in one place, of course, removing from another? Well, one of the edicts here, rightfully so, is that it's rain clouds that would go out to sea. So it's rain that would not be, you know, on any land mass, which is a fair point. So that's what they try to do anyway, to minimize, you know, any secondary effects of removing that water from the atmosphere.
Okay. You know, you mentioned a little bit of, basically about yourself there and your basic overview that you agree with the green approach to living your life, etc. and so forth. But what are some of the true, you know, environmental problems that you see out there as well? Because I see that there's a lot of those happening and taking place, but we hear very little about those. We can even mention the other controversy about these new green light bulbs that we're now given, and even the European Union have now decided that the old standard regular Edison glow light bulb is not allowed anymore, and everyone should now have these mercury-filled low-energy light bulbs, and if you drop one of these things, you have to leave the room for at least half an hour, because otherwise you can be experiencing mercury poisoning. What do you think about that? You know?
I didn't like the fact that I was being forced to change, and also I didn't really agree with the initial idea that it was to do with CO2. Now, being efficient and green, I mean, if there's a light bulb out there that is a better product, I mean, this, you know, it has to be on a product-by-product basis. You can't say, you know, green technologies are good or they're bad, depending on the product.
Of course.
If you have a light bulb that will poison you, and people drop light bulbs all the time, and if this is giving you mercury poisoning, which is a heavy metal and one of the worst forms of poison you can get, then that's not an improvement. Do you know what I mean? So
yes,
perhaps they shouldn't be used. I don't know about our local ones. I think sometimes they're based around fluorescence as well. I don't know. But as opposed to the old tungsten light bulb, which is a filament, of course. If it's an improvement and it's got longer life, yes. But I looked in my local shop, and they're mass producing the green ones now, and they're forcing you, actually.
Yes.
There's only a few, you know, old tungstens left. And I looked at the price and the number of hours. It was the same. Actually, slightly more expensive to get the green ones. As in, okay, it lasts, what is it, 4 or 5 times longer. But the price was about 8-9 times more. So I was thinking, well, I'm a bit annoyed that I'm being forced to buy them. And I don't like the white light. I know they say there's a warm version, but I don't find it very warm.
Yes.
The actual warm glow of a tungsten is quite pleasant. But anyway, that's what I guess.
Well, I'm actually glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the things I see as well, that I don't like the light from the new light bulbs, and it gives me a headache almost, because it has that fluorescent vibe to it, you know, and I like the old...
Yeah, it's cold.
Very cold, absolutely. So that's... From that point of view, we can even mention that has to do with the environment as well, the environment that human beings are in. And, you know, we want to create a pleasant environment for ourselves as well, you know. And the quality of all these things play into the picture as well. Because so many times I think that the human being as well is always left out of the debate, out of the conversation, if you will. And the fact that we have needs as well. You know, the simple fact that we up here in the north have to heat our houses, things like this. We can't just turn off the heat here. You know, we would die. And these some of these questions are not being brought up. Very obvious points. You know, and so again, then in my view, the debate is very unbalanced, James. That's what I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we're talking about light bulbs and whether it's nice and a feeling of warmth in our house, but it can go to a sort of a grander topic of, you know, giving cheap energy to Africans or allowing Brazilians or people in Indonesia to not grow cash crops, but food crops primarily, and maybe cash crops so they can afford it, as opposed to being forced to, well, their land taken from them in the first place from a corporation, or making cash crops, which is highly volatile and they can't feed themselves, you know. So you're right, and we are seen, you know, as a parasite, you know, in the extremist movement, we are viewed as a parasite and secondary. So you've got to find, you know, dare I say, a holistic solution that can fit both in minimizing our impact on the environment and also making sure that we have an environment we want to be in, whether it be having a nice warm glow from our light.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, absolutely. Very, very good point. Let's spend some time talking a little bit about climate gate as well then. I guess one of the points that we can begin discussing a little bit has to do with the medieval warm period or the medieval climate optimum. This seems to be one of the things that were meddled in regards to the emails leaked from the CRU and things like this. How much have you been looking into climate gate overall? Have you read some of the emails, or have you read mostly summaries in terms of climate gate? Again, there's so much data there, and I haven't myself had time to keep up with all the things that are being discovered every day, I guess, now in terms of the information in the emails. What about you, James?
Yeah, well, I haven't done a complete study where I would actually then write a script, but of course I have been following it quite avidly, and I've been looking at people's comments and their reviews, because it is, of course, a mass of emails. It was, compressed 61 megabytes of emails. And, you know, the whole thing, the concept of being a hack, well, I very much doubt it's a hack. We're all waiting for it with bated breath, is the more likely situation than as a whistleblower, and for him to come out, and that will be huge, you know, because hacked, you know, of course, means illegal, whereas whistleblowing is actually legal. So it actually turns the whole concept of this may be some dodgy underhand dealings done by the Climate Research Unit to being illegal doings. Willful prevention of the freedom of information that has been requested from them, changing of code, and I saw a snippet of code where they had a fudge factor in, which even the coder, and I do IT programming, and you have their comments, which you put by your lines of logic, and he even said, this is a bit dodgy, you know, this is, but I'm putting it in, and it's, you know, hampering the data set, and there's the whole concept of high decline, where, you know, the recent history of the tree rings was, just didn't fit with the actual, temperature record, the surface temperature record, so they just got rid of it. Mixing more than one data set, you know, and taking the parts, splicing the parts, which you find most favorable to show this huge hockey stick upturn in the last century. And all of this stuff, you know, this is not news for people who are perhaps skeptical about this whole CO2 thing. It's not news. I mean, this has all been analyzed statistically, and this has all been looked at, and people have done alternative bits of evidence. Like Lowell, he did a really good study, which I pointed out in the movie, he's using data sets of a variety of kind, whether it be sediments or whether it be other sort of proxies, but across the world. So different types of evidence and across the world. So not just one site in America with bristlecone pines, you know, and then he will show you what we all thought up until global warming was invented. We talk about global warming invented. Is what we all thought anyway, just reaffirming that was already the agreed concept that there was a little ice age in the early 1800s when the Thames was, you know, frozen over and they had ice fairs and they played hockey and they sold whatever candy cane or whatever they sold in those days, pre-candy cane. And, you know, there was a big warming in the medieval period in which, you know, out of the mud, you know, you think of the Dark Ages, they were making Gothic cathedrals, which are more impressive than anything the Roman Empire ever came up with.
Yes.
And that, how can you do that? It's money, it's wealth. And what is wealth in those days? It's primarily, it's food production. You know, all this stuff Chaucer talks about vineyards in the north of England.
Yeah.
Oh my, I'm not sure it would be the nicest wine in the world, but it had vineyards in the north of England, you know. So, I mean, all the anecdotal evidence, as we call it, you know, and the Vikings in Greenland and their appearance and sudden disappearance, as of course, why did they disappear? Well, their food supply. disappeared. It got too cold. And however, the Inuits, or the Eskimos, whatever you want to call them, they survived through all that because they had a different diet. So all of the evidence that we've known prior to the whole sort of the concept of global warming, or this catastrophic global warming, to be more precise, it is all been reaffirmed by other studies. And suddenly it's taken away from us with the man hockey stick. And you got to think there's something going wrong there.
In other words, also what you're saying here is that the climate has always been changing, but now for some reason people are rallying behind something that basically we or they then don't have any power over. It's like protesting against the fact that summer is moving in, in one of the northern or southern hemispheres. We can't really do anything about it in that way, but we have the illusion that we affect it so incredibly much, but we don't. But the basic idea again is that the climate has always been changing and it will continue to do so, right, James?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I go quite carefully in the whole idea of how much CO2 can affect us. There is a minute, absolutely agreeable, direct CO2 effect, which it just changing the solar force, the actual energy balance. There is no disagreement with that. There are certain bandwidths of radiation that CO2 absorbs it, but the problem is CO2 is already saturated. And so it's law of diminishing returns. You can double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere and 1 degree will go up. That's all the atmosphere is going to go up. That's the agreed portion. And then there's this positive feedback, which is the huge matter of debate. But there is absolutely, as far as I've seen, and I've researched quite a lot, I've researched for 2 years quite solidly, I haven't seen a single iota of evidence to back this secondary, feedbacks. Yeah, so it's always been changing. And I can perhaps describe, and I do think I describe, the reasons why, the most plausible reasons why, which is to do with the sun and the sea, what's why climate is changing. And by the way, 1 degree increase in temperature over the next century or two is really going to be an awesome thing. It's going to feed the planet. It's a good thing. And natural variation, as we know, is natural variation. There's always noise in the system, and there's also forcings, so there's different layers of changes. But changes are always happening. They always have happened. And there's nothing we can do about it. What we have to do is we adapt. Our effect in, some spurious claims of throwing, sulfates into the atmosphere, some whack, idea of churning sulfates into the atmosphere to prevent sunlight coming in to cool us down again. Oh, my God. Mm. Sulfate is a pollutant, not CO2. CO2 yes. is not a pollutant. It is a vital component. It's a central component for life. No shape or form you can ever consider CO2 a pollutant. And these ideas that we can prevent the atmosphere changing one way or the other is very spurious. And the best way, let's go for argument's sake of argument, CO2 is the problem. Well, okay, if CO2 is the problem, actually, any of our CPRS, any of our emissions trading schemes will do absolutely sweet FA, basically, change to that. We can say, if we in Australia invested $50 billion by 2020, as in just threw this money at this scheme, which is not really, as we discussed, it's not benefiting industry, it's not really benefiting society, it's really good money thrown at bad ideas, then we only do 10% reduction in CO2. So instead of spending $50 billion on this scheme, why don't we spend the $50 billion on relocating people, building dams, or whatever? That's, like people in Holland, they're quite well-versed in looking after changing, sea levels.
True.
So even, So even for devil's argument that CO2 is a problem, that wouldn't be the right way to go about it.
Your question basically is, are we spending that amount of money on the right place, right? That's what you're saying.
Exactly. We can spend a lot better adapting than trying to prevent our development and preventing the changes in the environment, which we can't stop. We can't stop the sun and the oceans doing what they want to do.
Exactly. And then again, the question of how much CO2 we actually do put into the atmosphere as well is an important point in all this. I mean, people have been looking into effect of volcanoes, for instance, even a simple thing as that. And there was a article a while back, which stated that basically 16 ships, we're talking oil tankers here, create as much pollution as all the cars in the world. So our cars aren't producing that much. There's the question. But you touch upon this idea of how much CO2 we actually put into the atmosphere in your film. Tell us a little bit about that, James.
Well, the amount of CO2 we put into the atmosphere is minute. See, the CO2 in the atmosphere is virtually the humongous overriding important factor on atmospheric CO2 is the oceans. And it's a simple equilibrium between CO2 and carbonic acid in the oceans. And that's all to do with heat. So when the oceans heat up, they can't contain as much CO2, so you get more CO2 in the atmosphere. So really, that's CO2 balance. Now, there's other things you can go with. Volcanoes, yes, they can churn out CO2, and they can churn out sulfates, which does sulfate cooling from. But that's a short-term sort of problem. Situation. Mm-hmm. You know, it can actually affect, let's say, the weather systems of the world. Was it Mount Pinatubo or whatever? It affected maybe for a year. It changed it slightly. But these are all relatively minor effects. You have, of course, the CO2 going in and out, so the CO2 balance between plants and methane from animals has been cited. And there's other sort of inputs and determining factors. At the end of the day, it's about the oceans. That is the major factor. And it's not. And our contribution to the CO2, see, I gave us a 25% contribution, which is really being very, very generous mm-hmm. in the movie. What I tried to do in the movie was actually not be controversial. The CO2 balance is extremely complex. And you know what? Instead of spending money on cutting down trees and planting plantations for ethanol replaced, you know, petrol, we should be spending money and spending all this money on climate models. We should be spending money on research that actually makes a difference. Now, for instance, we don't really know how different types of vegetation balance. So, you know, when they absorb CO2 to create sugars and create life, a foundation of life, and of course, when they die, they break down and release that again. Mm. And the actual balances between that, we don't really know about. They are extremely important. You know, so we should be spending all this money that we've been throwing at these climate models, you know, billions on these climate models, 50 billion has been thrown since 1990, I think it was, at this sort of research.
God.
And it's the wrong place. We could throw that money at actual, you know, experiments that look into the real physical and biological factors that do create the balances in energy and carbon dioxide and these sort of things. You know, I mean, that's the problem. You see, thinking, well, you know, this is a good thing. I mean, okay, maybe there isn't global warming because of CO2, but at least we're spending money on research, but we're spending it on the wrong research. There's a bias to it. It's perhaps distorting where the natural flow of ideas should go. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So it's not a good thing. You can't just say that throwing money at it is good because if you're throwing at it in the wrong approach.
Absolutely. And again, you have a situation then where a lot of, you know, scientists, they get grants and tenure doing this kind of research. Companies are set up in order to investigate these things. There's even the question of, you know, in terms of cap and trade, that there is also monitoring systems now that are supposed to be installed in various industries and things like this, where a lot of people are going to make huge amounts of money. They're going to be, what do they call it? The Microsoft, but of the of the cap and trade kind of world, if you know what I mean, meaning these operating systems that are monitoring how much carbon you're putting out at your factory or whatever it is that you have. So again, we have this idea that there's just a new kind of economy coming in from somewhere, and so many people are jumping on the bandwagon that it seems to be difficult to just stop it. You know what I mean, James?
Absolutely. I mean, because we have that in our own company. We would have to measure, even though we are a renewable company, you might have an engineer, you know, who's using his car to go between your different generation assets, and that's got to be included in the budget and how much in your cap and trade scheme that counts as a, you know, a quota, part of your quota. So you have to say, well, that engineer spent 3 hours in his vehicle today. You have to write that down, you have to log it, you know, you have to check, you have maybe a company petrol pump or something like that, and you have to measure the amount of easy enough measured how much you've used, but then you have to say, well, that turns into so many, you know, gigatons or just tons of carbon dioxide. So this is a huge layer of bureaucracy, and bureaucracy can mean money and jobs, as you say. And at the end of the day, you're saying, well, it's bureaucracy, so it's not a good thing. You're actually stagnating. You're actually slowing industry down.
Yes.
You know what I mean? But yes, there is money involved, and there's jobs, so-called new jobs being created, but there's a lot more jobs being lost because of it.
Well, exactly. I mean, just look at the car industry. You know, all of this goes hand in hand with the, obviously, the economic situation now as well, but I also see that is a reflection of the whole, you know, climate change debate as well, because it's almost like people frown on production now, and we're not supposed to have cars, but at the same time, yet at least, we don't see the emergence of new developing companies that are actually doing something, you know, good and productive when it comes to you know, battery driven cars and stuff like this. Apparently France, for instance, has developed a car that goes on air, even as the taxi companies have begun to buy this, for instance. I mean, there's a lot of good ideas out there, you know, but at the same time, it doesn't seem that that industry has yet boomed. Do you think that that will happen then? Do you think that that will be the next step of this? And we're just kind of in the middle of the phase right now where everything seems to be chaotic and whatnot. Okay, though, we have to go back to this general idea again and mention that it's all based on a lie, on a fraud. So the question is, how long will those kind of industries actually maintain and stay healthy? Because it's based on a very insecure foundation, if you know what I mean, James.
Yeah, it's a very big deal. I mean, and as we hinted at earlier, I mean, I would want the bubble to explode. You know, there's a lot of companies, and companies exploit opportunities, and generally companies are quite honest about it. We're exploiting an opportunity. We don't know whether there is CO2-based level warming or not, but we will design the next version of the Prius or whatever because people want to buy it, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of money invested into green technologies and you can say, well, there's benefits. You know, we have better wind power, which we do have better wind power now. The turbines are more efficient and the solar panels are getting better. And the hybrid car concept was definitely promoted through the fact that there was a business opportunity. So you say, oh, well, it's all great. But the amount of money being thrown at this is highly, highly inefficient. And whenever you're creating it's a false economy. And so just to say that, well, we have a Prius car because of, you know, the global warming. Well, you know, but how many billions has been put in and invested into this to get there? Well, you could have spent a lot less than that if you actually just wanted to design a hybrid car for your own sake, you know. Those sort of drivers are not the way to go. I mean, we're talking about basic economics, the arguments of whether, you know, regulated versus deregulated. You've created a regulated car. It's the industry has said, look, you have to have that car. Well, oh, sorry, in a way it's been regulated because it's a false economy. It's a false profit situation because it shouldn't be there.
Mm. It's weird to me. I'm reading a little bit about General Motors, for instance. They have a car they call the EV1. There's other companies, I think, as well, who had very efficient battery-driven cars that many of these were taken off market around, you know, 2000 or something like that, meaning that there was technology in place. But then for whatever reason, they were, like, recalled and they haven't continued the production of them, which makes me, you know, look twice at this stuff. And, like, I wonder why that is then. Why haven't they followed through on this and actually developed a lot of this technology? I don't know if you have any answers or not on that, James, but it's just a curiosity, a side note to this whole discussion, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know the business model which, you know, the General Motors and getting these electric cars out is based on. I mean, so I don't work for those guys. But I do know General Motors is, you know, it's a highly political company. And they really are trying to go for the green angle, and they are promoting it largely. So if they produced, I imagine, a car which is some sort of hybrid or battery-driven car, fully battery-driven car, and it's taking it off the market, then I don't think they'll be happy about that. There is some economic reason why it's just not viable. Because as far as they were concerned, especially in 2000, the world was really pro this whole global warming thing. So the market seemed like it was going to boom. So, you know, I don't know why they removed their car then.
See, very, very interesting. But how do you, you know, if we begin to round things up a little bit here for this time, Jens, how do you think the world will look back on this issue, let's say, I don't know, 50 or maybe even 100 years from now? I'm asking for your prophetic hat to be put on here, I guess. But at the same time, it has been mentioned before that it's a mass delusion, pretty much, that we see is unfolding right now. And the future human being might look back to this era as the dark ages when it comes to, you know, intelligence, if nothing else, and just wonder and question what the heck were they thinking? Didn't they realize, you know, the basic simplicity when it comes to the scientific models, etc. What do you think, James? Will we come out of this and realize what really is going on here, or will the propaganda work? And we will just carry on into this direction. Where do you see things going?
Well, I mean, of course, you're a good question. Big question. Well, I'm an optimist, so I think we're going to come out of this well. As I've already mentioned, you know, Jonathan Swift said in this 1726 or some time when he wrote the book, you know, this sort of thing is this sort of bubble and this sort of investing into craziness and everyone believing in it and not really, you know, the emperor's clothing sort of concept has gone on forever. In 100 years' time, looking back, you know, in 100 years' time, we could say, oh, well, you know, that's just another little bit of history repeating. We just fell into that bubble, the Y2K bubble, whatever. The alternative is, you know, in 100 years' time, mankind will be more developed. Africa and India will be better off. You know, you see places like Thailand and Malaysia and Indonesia, they've come on leaps and bounds. So other countries that are perhaps further behind in this scale, hopefully will sort themselves out. Zimbabwe, we would love to really sort itself out if we can. And hopefully the world will be a better place. And we might say, well, actually, you know, we agree that the CO2 thing was slightly spurious, but what it led us to is this awesome world government. You know, we could actually say, you know, that, okay, we agree that it was spurious. And this is what some of the reasons why this whole thing has been pushed. And I will also mention the world government as a final thought, I guess, is that I try not to be too cynical. But in the day, the way I see it is Maggie Thatcher started the whole thing as a genuine energy concern. She couldn't have coal, she couldn't trust her coal unions, and oil had just quadrupled by OPEC. She needed nuclear, so she started it. And it's now been, who are the main people that I can see carrying on? It's the European Union, people like Prime Minister Gordon Brown especially, President Barack Obama and Kevin Rudd. They're all on the left side of politics. And why are they must have advisors telling, they must have advisors saying, look, there's actually quite a lot of people out there who are quite validly saying that it's probably not true. Why are we going to put this tax in? And you know what? Taxes are usually don't mean votes. So they really must have a reason. Do you know what I mean? I mean, if you actually just going through the logic, the thought experiment, they must have a reason, because putting in a tax is not votes. And politicians are very sensitive to keeping votes.
Yes.
So what is their reason? What is their raison d'etre? What is it behind it? Well, that comes to the concept that, and there are many people out there who believe in it, maybe there should be a world government. And at the moment, I don't think we can do that, because our societies are too imbalanced. You know, you can't say that there's one rule of law for someone like Belgium the same as it would be for Kenya. This wouldn't work. But maybe in 100 years' time, we would have got to that stage, and we'll say, well, that was this cap-and-trade scheme is a form of taxation which is allowing an intergovernmental, international body, whether it be the UN or, you know, based on the EU sort of format, a UN to have its own taxation, therefore its own control. And so maybe this was a good thing. It was a progenitor of a great concept, but I don't know. I mean, I'm a bit more cynical, but that's one other way to look at it.
Well, absolutely. It is all about who is in control, finally. If that system indeed goes into place, international law, one world government, who is the people at the top? Because those who are pushing the European Union now and other unions around the world is not people that I would like to see, you know, in charge of a world government. You know, definitely.
Absolutely, they're not elected. And I just quickly mentioned, I was in the European Youth Parliament, and I loved it. I had an amazing time. I was there in Göteborg, and I was, you know, there in your country initially, and then I went to a follow up conference, and it was amazing. It was like, you know, over 1,000 kids. You know, I say kids, you know, 17 to 20 year olds debating, and it was all sponsored by the European Union. And you have the, you know, the high up European members of parliament there. And it was very much, and I loved it. And I absolutely say only good things about it. But it was made plain and clear. There's no secrecy about it. But what their vision is to remove nations.
Yes.
It was what it is. It's what they say. And I believed in the idea until now. I've become a bit older, perhaps a bit more cynical, and don't believe in non-transparent bureaucracies, which is what the European Union is.
Yeah.
But the actual concept, the basic principle, I would agree with, which is we have problems in Europe. We've always had these problems throughout time. And you can talk about the World Wars and Hitler and the sort of the Third Reichs, the First, Second, and Third Reichs and all that. And you can say, well, we had problems in Europe because we're always fighting over resources and power. So nations are a problem. Let's get rid of the nations. And let's say we have a local government for your local area, so it looks after your local concerns. So that would be maybe as large as perhaps as, you know, a mayor of a city or a town. No national government, and then you have a European government. That is the philosophy. That is very much honest, and that was what it is. And at the time, I thought it sounded like a great idea. It's only when you later find out that these people are non-transparent. And the thing is, it just doesn't work, because even in the European Union, which is pretty standardized, we're still so different. You know, the French like things differently very much to the Italians.
Yes.
We like it different to the Swissies. You know, so it's very hard to say there's one rule of law for everybody.
Well, absolutely. You're absolutely right there. And I see at the end of the day that this is actually not endorsing diversity. It's creating a form of kind of a monoculture, and it creates kind of a same thing across the world, and we see a lot of the diversity from around the planet actually going away. I think that there should be able to be peaceful, you know, cooperations between nations down to the individual, without having to remove that they have to live under the exact same laws and stuff like that. Because again, absolutely, this goes back to this tribal idea that you mentioned before. Just let people be and be in their own little crowd that they want to be in, and let them decide for themselves. And I think ultimately that we would be better off by that, you know. But again, the experiment, as it were, of a one world government is moving forward, and I don't like the direction where it's headed, especially with the people who are pulling the strings, as it were.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, because the one thing, when I was still living in the UK, the thing I was occasionally I'd hear in the newspaper, I mean, oh my God, I mean, I'm so cynical of newspapers myself. But one thing I heard, which was good, was that, you know, the European Human Rights Commission would sometimes, you know, have some good rulings. You know, they would overrule some sort of really high profile, maybe a terrorist is in prison falsely by its government. And there is some sort of, even the government can't do what it wants. You know, there's some sort of uber body above that. Mm. And sometimes that was good. You know, this whole detention thing in Britain is starting to scare me. It's turning like a police state. I don't know how they're getting away with some of the laws.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need a body above them to tell them. But that's not necessarily to say that's a regulation. And I believe there should be some sort of regulation there, which is some sort of agreed, you know, like at the end of the day, European Union can't really tell Britain what to do, but Britain agrees to be told.
Mm.
But I'm not saying control. You know, that's not total control. I don't think total control works. Some sort of regulation perhaps does work. But it's, you know, but the European Union is going for total control, and that is their modus operandi. That is their agenda, and it's plain and simple and open.
Absolutely.
And they want to use that framework for the UN, so that, you know, that's what they're saying. That's the impression I'm getting, shall we say?
Yes.
Is that the European Union is a framework which they're setting up, and they've been adjusting and modifying over the last, you know, 20 years, or even say since, you know,
oh,
the,
50 or 60 years. Yes.
Since World War II, you know, when it started off in its early form. As you know, under the concepts of NATO and all that, and once they have, you know, got the right sort of balance, they want to put it as an international body, and they've done. And the UN has been trying to get control for a long, long time. Mm. And the problem with the UN, of course, is that most of its funding is coming from America, as far as I've heard, and so therefore they're obviously a bit unhappy that they have this, their arms are tied behind the back by America. So if they can get this cap and trade in, they have their own independent source of funding. Mm. Now you're talking world government.
Yes. Absolutely. There's so many things that lead to the one place here, as you mentioned, and we'll have to see and track and follow how this develops as well. And I think this is a good time, James, to begin to round things up here for this time. I want to just ask
a little bit
more about your the availability of your film and so forth, if you have it as a DVD version or not available on your site, and basically just also ask you what's next for you? Are you continuing on the research path on similar subject matters, or are you what's up next for you, James?
Thanks for asking, Henry. Yeah, so I was lucky to get the climatereview.net, and I've kept it very, very simple. I have some references to some other blogs and websites that you might find interesting. I have my little bio, so you can hear about who I am. I admit freely that I'm not a climatologist professor. I'm more of an independent person who's just spent some time looking into it, trying to look from an independent viewpoint. I have I spent a lot of thought on delivery of the product. I didn't go with DVDs in the end because I think, well, the easiest thing, anyone in the world, and you have unlimited bandwidth, is YouTube. So I've spent a lot of time trying to make the YouTube quality very, very good, which I think has come out to fruition.
Absolutely.
So you can download YouTube. And if you are interested in the whole thing, you can have it. I've given you, you guys, if you're interested, a Windows and a Mac version of the whole movie, and you can have it yourself in high definition, because, of course, DVD is in high definition. So it's available in high definition there for you.
Oh, that's excellent. That's very well made, James. And so just on the finishing note then, are you planning to do any more films, or what's next?
Well, actually, this interview is a great start. So I'm thinking we're getting some interest. I mean, initially it was slow, but then a few very excellent websites like climategate.com referenced me, and then suddenly other people around the world were hosting the movie as well, and it started to blossom in the last couple of weeks. And if this blossoming still occurs and people are interested, then I would be very happy to carry on, maybe do a movie on ClimateGate. I'll probably do mini movies on topics, you know, perhaps more of a sort of a blog type concept, or maybe do a little mini movie on ClimateGate and sum up the whole situation, which I think would be very interesting to a lot of people. And maybe, new field of topics that come out, like the Lindzen Choi climate forcing paper, maybe discuss that, or maybe go completely different, you know, talk about 2012 and whether the planet's going to blow itself up, which of course it probably won't, but the other perhaps avenues could be available.
There's plenty of material out there. Thank you so much for your time, James. Keep up the great work and keep us posted and informed, and we'd love to have you back at some point as well in the program talking more about your research.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Henrik, for this opportunity to speak to your viewers and your listeners.
That's our program with James Follett from climatereview.net. If you haven't seen it already, head on over to his website and check out Church of Global Warming. Thank you for listening and for joining us here in the member section. We'll be back with more radio before you know it. Fredrik, Elizabeth and Lana, my thanks to you guys. Keep an eye on our website for upcoming guests and topics. We will talk more soon. Take good care. Bye-bye.